Goddard Reel 6. What were the mechanics of landing?
Well, on this, in the circuit, perhaps you went up to 1,000 feet or more, then you had to bring her down and bring her head to wind over the landing party, stationary at about 20 feet or 30 feet up. That was the right way to do it, so that you would... But you didn't put your... you didn't have any wheels on most of these aircraft, because we used to, in fact, we had skids underneath. But we didn't attempt to skid along the land. We attempted to come in head to wind, slow, and stop over the landing party and drop the trail rope into their hands. That, of course, was the ideal. But, in fact, we didn't usually achieve that. There was no set routine about it. The wind is fairly turbulent over a landing ground when there's any wind at all. And we would bring the ship down, and while bringing her down, we would have to keep the engine running pretty fast to blow up the pressure, which was continually falling all the time you were coming into denser air. As you can understand, this is a relative matter. As the pressure outside increases, relatively the pressure inside decreases. Consequently, you must blow more air into the ballonets. That meant you had to open the crab pots by strings from the control car and watch your pressure gauges and keep the ship at the right pressure. Well, that would mean, with the engine running pretty fast, you were quite likely, if there was any strong wind, if the wind wasn't strong, I should have said, to overshoot the landing party, or to come over the landing party, not hovering, but actually going ahead at some speed. You would then drop your trail rope, and you might be well above the height required, because you'd misjudged how quickly you could come down. That would mean that the landing party would probably have to grab onto your rope, and the stalwarts amongst them who first caught on would probably be dragged along the ground with you as a sort of live anchors trailing across the ground, and others would then tag onto the rope, and it could be quite a higgledy-piggledy mess of a whole lot of men trying to stop you going ahead. But as I said, when the thing was done properly, there would be no turmoil at all. Well, then they would pull down on the trail rope until the pennants on the four guys, those are the wires hanging down on either side of the nose, came within reach of the four guys' leading hand, who would thread his rope through the eye at the end of the wire pennant, and then he would quickly double that up, and so that the men detailed for the four guys on the port side and the starboard side could grab hold of those guys and keep the ship head to wind. And then by that time, the control car, or the skids of the control car, would be in the hands of the party who had first grabbed the trail rope. And there she would then be held by the men, the four car party, or at least the car party, holding onto the skids of the fuselage, and the four guys would also be manned. Then the last thing to happen would be that the pennants of the after guys, that is in the tail end of the ship, towards the tail end of the ship, those pennants would come near enough to the ground to be grabbed by the men, or the leading hands detailed for the after guys, and they would go through the same procedure of threading their handling ropes through the eye of the pennant, and the after guys would then be manned. And when the officer in charge of the landing was satisfied that the ship was secure and held head to wind and was in reasonable state of balance, not too heavy or too light, they would say either walk the ship astern, or walk the ship ahead, or walk the ship to starboard, or walk the ship to port, whichever it was, and would move towards the hangar. And then when you got near the hangar, You would come within the area that was supposed to be guarded by the wind screens of the hangars. And if you look at a picture of hangars in those days, you will find that built out on either side of the hangar doors, there were great corrugated iron vertical screens which were meant to prevent the wind from blowing the ship sideways when you were doing the tricky process of putting her into the jaws of the hangar, into the door, through the doorway. For big ships, there wouldn't be much clearance, and it was very important that the ship shouldn't be blown sideways so that it damaged itself on the side of the hangar or damaged the hangar.
Were they effective?
But they were exceedingly ineffective, really, because when the wind was strong, and that was the only time you need bother about a crosswind, they created such turbulence that the wind was gusting and rolling around from various directions inside there and buffeting the ship about in a very unsteady way, and you'd really been better off without the windscreens. But it was an amateur's idea of shielding the ship against a crosswind, but in fact it created a worse danger, worse hazard than... And after a while, we began by partially stripping these windscreens of their... This is a great sidetrack, but partially stripping these windscreens of their corrugated iron to let some of the air come through, and then taking it off altogether. And in fact, in later times, windscreens were not built on either sides of the hangars at all.
I get the impression that the process of landing the airship was the most difficult and perhaps slightly hazardous part of the operation. Could you give me any examples of the kind, from your own experience, of the kind of problems that arose?
Well, yes. You see, unless you were trained and had a complete understanding of your airship, you would not know how long it would take you to make your descent, that is to say, to blow up the pressure to keep the balloon in shape. And if you came down too fast, as I've said before, your nose would blow in and the ship would become flabby and your controls wouldn't operate properly. And so you took a varying length of time to come down, depending on the efficiency with which you operated the crab pots, which opened the valves to let the air into the ballonets. So that was one field in which misjudgment could be made. The other...
What were the most common hazards that the members of the ground crew would experience?
Well, to begin with, they had to be stalwarts who, once they grabbed the trail rope, which might be snaking through the ground quite fast, I mean as much as 10 or 15 miles, perhaps 20 miles an hour, they would suddenly find themselves, if they grabbed hard, dragged across the ground at very high speed, unless they were joined by two or three other stalwarts who flung themselves onto the rope as well. And this became more, rougher than a rugger scrum. You can imagine a whole bunch of men grabbing onto a rope and determining not to let go. Once you'd got it, you didn't let go. And until the ship's speed was arrested... Of course, it shouldn't have any speed at all. It should be landing head to wind. Mm. But on calm days, because of what I've just described about keeping up the pressure, she very often was going quite fast. Mm. Then the other thing was that when your landing party was really grabbing onto this and was vertically below you, and you found that you were heavier than you expected, or you were coming down faster than you liked and it looked like hitting the ground... Indeed, you might be heavy because the sun might have gone in while you were approaching the landing and your gas had cooled down, and you might really be coming down quite fast, in which case you would let go a lot of water ballast. That would immediately swamp the crew who had already gone through that's the ground crew, the landing party. They'd get swamped with your water ballast coming down, or those who were vertically below you, because quickly it would turn into a sort of shower bath of spray, and you'd get quite wet. Well, that was one thing. And then, of course, there was another thing. It was a rule that no man, however much he might want to help to land the airship, if the airship came over with its trail rope not reaching the ground at all, but just within hand height, a man could easily get more or less electrocuted with the static charge that would go down through his body to the ground. So it was a rule that nobody was supposed to touch the landing rope until it had first of all earthed itself and snaked along the ground a bit. And of course that usually happened. I only saw one man ever knocked over backwards by an electric shock, but it was quite a usual thing for the enthusiast to forget this rule, and very often a chap would take a very nasty shock. Just enough, I mean, to make him fall over backwards. I never knew anything fatal come from that.
Now, towards the end of 1915, you went to Capel to take up your first operational flight. What can you tell me about Capel as an airship station?
Well, when the submarine menace began to be important in the naval mind, the political field, it was decided, Lord Fisher decided as first Sea Lord, to develop the airship and use it as a submarine searcher. And the model which was fixed on was the ITA, and the first station to be built to house this airship, or its the following small airships which were to be built, was Capel, which lies between Dover and Folkestone on the top of the cliffs. And Capel Le Ferne, if you look for it on the map. And so one hangar was built, adequate to house the ITA. And soon after, two more hangars were built, also to house two of these small airships, so that six airships altogether could be housed in this place. But the first hangar to be built was meant to house, as I've said, airships of the size of the ITA, whereas the SS types of ship that we have talked about were of larger dimensions. And were too tall, in fact, almost too broad to go into this hangar, which consequently had to have a trench dug from beyond the doors on at either end, so that the car of the airship should go down to a lower level than the original floor, and so that the floor then took you to a height where you could actually touch the envelope of the ship, and thereby hangs a story which I could tell you about another time. These hangars were equipped with windscreens on either side, and so this first of the chain of airship stations round the coast, Capel Le Ferne, became the first operational station for blimps, and SS-1 was sent there, followed by other ships and whose numbers I don't really remember, except that it included later on when I was there SS-12, SS-13, I think SS-5 and 7.
Could you tell me the scale of it when you actually arrived there at the end of 15?
Yes, there were in fact six SS airships captained by contemporaries of mine who were all a bit senior to me because I was the junior of the two batches of young officers who came out of the Navy. And my ship had just been reconstituted, having been its envelope having been burnt in an accident on the top of the cliffs. But the fuselage of my ship belonged to the SS-1, and I took over from the captain of SS-1, really, and he went off to command a coastal-type airship, which was of a larger sort.
One thing which intrigues me about your going to Capel to take up immediate command of an SS airship is that from our previous discussions it's clear that you'd had very little practical experience of flying airships. Do you think you were a competent airship pilot at the time you arrived there to take over operational duties?
I don't think I was really, with hindsight now, a very competent airship pilot at that time. But you must remember that I had had a lot of experience in handling ships of various kinds, small, admittedly small ones. I'd been in the Navy for 7 years, since the age of 12 and a half. I had been to sea quite a bit. I knew how I'd steered ships. I'd been on the bridge of a destroyer, and I had been captain of a picket boat. I'd seen my own ship come alongside repeatedly. And bringing an airship to a landing party and throwing out a rope to be hauled down and close alongside, so to speak, in the vertical plane, is very, very similar to handling a ship in the water and coming alongside a jetty, or handling a ship in a tideway is very similar to flying an airship in a wind. So I didn't really feel there was any difference in principle between flying an airship and flying and sailing or steering a ship on the water, except the fact that this airship had the peculiarity of having to be kept in shape. And, of course, it did have a different form of propulsion. But otherwise, to me and to everybody else in the Navy, an airship was just a ship which happened to be fly in the air instead of swimming in the water.
Do you think, with the wisdom of hindsight, that the training which you'd received for the work that you were about to start doing was adequate to that task?
Well, I would say that with hindsight, a great deal of more could have been made of dual control, of duplicating the controls in the front and the back seats of an airship, so that you learnt to fly in a proper instructional thing with proper communication between the instructor